So podcasts are not actually set in time. They're kind of, in a strange way, now is whenever you turn it on. So if I say, for instance, last night, it has no meaning because you might be listening to this podcast that I'm recording now, and I'm not going to tell you when because I want you to feel like last night really was last night, even if you're listening to this 6 months into the future from last night. I'm not going to give you the date. I'm not going to tell you when I recorded this podcast, ever. I think this is a new rule for me. I'll never say when I'm recording a podcast so that I can always say, last night I saw a movie. And last night I saw a movie called Flora and Son. And it starred a woman named Eve Hewson, who just happens to be Bono, the guy from U2. That's his daughter. But she's 31 years old and she's an established actress. So why am I telling you that? I don't know. What I will tell you is, it was a really interesting movie. For many reasons, but primarily for this one, is that the character was a very sort of sexy, like enjoys her sexuality woman who also happened to be a very bad mother. And she's the hero of the story. And she, over the course of the movie, the two things that are interesting to me are that in a lot of movies, if they have an attractive woman who enjoys her sexuality, she gets punished for it somehow. Somehow she gets punished for being that woman. Like her sluttiness is damned, and it's kind of a trope in movies. I've seen it over and over again. But in this movie, this woman's sexuality was not in any way her downfall, and it wasn't directly connected to her being a bad mother. The other interesting thing is that in the movie, she does have growth and a moral arc, and she goes from being a really bad mother to being like a pretty bad mother. And yet you are excited for her. You see some growth. It was just a really interesting movie. It was made by the same people that made the movie Once, which was a movie about sort of the way that music brought these two people together and created a wonderful bond between them. And it was kind of like an ode to music. And this movie was too. The key action is that this woman sort of comes into the possession of a guitar and takes some lessons, and they transform her in many ways and transform her relationship with her son. And I won't take it through. I'm just going to say that what I liked about the movie is that this woman was a bad mother, but she was still somebody you liked, and that she was hypersexual in some ways, but that wasn't portrayed as a bad thing, and it wasn't also portrayed for like purient sexy value. That wasn't her primary attraction. It was just a feature of her personality. And I really so I liked the way it handled the sexuality. I liked the way it handled moral growth, and I really liked the ending of it, because the ending of it was not too neat and tidy, but yet very satisfying. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm just going to say I saw a movie last night and it was really good. And it was short. It was sweet. It didn't hurt me in any way. It was like a really good hamburger meal. Like, it's not the best meal you've ever had, but like sometimes you really want a hamburger. And this was one of those hamburger movies. And I'm telling that to you because, you know, you might need a movie like that tonight. And I'm telling that to you, John Wright, because you always like to talk about movies.
It sounds good, and I added it to my list.
There you go.
Yeah, I added it to I have an Apple Note, you know, like one of those. It comes up on my computer and also on my phone. And I have a note of all the movies like I want to watch or things I want to see. And I even have two lists in there. One is with Randy and one is solo, because I know that there are some things she will not be interested in.
Yes.
I added this one to the Both of Us Together list.
Yeah, it's a total date movie. So because you're on the episode, that's a clear indication that this is going to be a Q&A episode, or a Q&R episode, as we like to call it.
Yes, question and response.
Right on.
Because we have no answers here.
Yeah, that's right. So it's so funny that I say that at the beginning, and then I talk like I am the king of the world.
Like we have an answer, yeah.
Yeah. But what do you got?
All right, here's a question for you. Bart, it seems clear that as a society, we agree less and less on what facts are true. This is most obvious in our politics, but it also applies to our personal lives. The phrase, my truth, seems quite revealing. More and more people are insisting their perspectives shouldn't be challenged. In the middle of this truth crisis, how do you think humanists like us can contribute to a better future with regard to knowledge?
What a positive and uplifting question. No, like, how can we contribute? That's, I like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, as you're reading the question, I would say that, you know, it is a crisis of truth, but I guess for human beings like us, it's really a crisis of trust. That yeah. You see a lot of information floating around and you don't know if it's true. Mm-hmm. And from what I, not that I have done extensive research, but from one of the things that people, when they are bloviating about AI and the dangers of artificial intelligence, is they're saying that, like, the ability to fake things, to fake photographs, to fake articles, to fake whole websites and put words and images in other people's mouths and lives, it's going to be frighteningly easy moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cheaper and cheaper, easier and easier.
Yeah. So you just, there's a real crisis of trust where who we trust, what sources we trust, what sources we don't trust, that people don't seem to be able to agree on that. I think the person's right about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that phrase, my truth, this is my truth. What do you think that means?
I always kind of assumed that it came out of New Age to some extent, like a lot of the things that we, you know, like people talk about manifesting. I'm going to go and manifest this reality to happen now. That came out of that, the whole New Age thing as well. It's like the quietest sort of revolution in our language, I think, is all the stuff that is sort of like magical thinking that gets perpetuated along these lines. And my truth fits right into that to me, where it just kind of means like, hey, you know, I'm living my truth. I'm, you know, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't even matter what evidence you throw at it or what facts you have for me. This is my truth. And it makes them kind of impervious to evidence or even logic.
That it you know, it's so interesting. Like, you think it comes out of
the same place as crystals and manifesting things, and yeah, I do.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I think about it, I think it. You're blaming the New Age movement, and maybe it's the same thing. I'm blaming Oprah Winfrey.
Oh yeah, there's all the same thing. Maybe yeah,
because I feel like, you know, that's the kind of phrase that you would hear on her show. You know, speak your truth.
Yes.
You know, I so appreciated her. She spoke her truth, or his mm-hmm, truth.
Mm-hmm.
And
I can even think of direct Oprah examples where I would have an issue with that, which we won't go into. But yeah, I do. And I like Oprah.
Yeah,
it's impossible not to like. Yeah. But I agree with you. I think it might be kind of that whole, you know, someone's going to now tell you their story, but the story can't be challenged. I think that's kind of a part of it, don't you?
Yeah, I think that the phrase your truth undermines the idea of shared common facts. Like that, so that if you say something and I go like, hey, I want to challenge that. You know, like I have a counterexample. And the idea is like, ultimately there's one thing that's true and we're arguing to try to figure out what that one thing is. And the person's like, no, this is my truth.
Right. Yes.
And it's unchallengeable because like it's drawn from my experience. This is what the world looks like from where I stand, and so this is true for me.
It's almost as though we've gotten better at listening to people, right, and their experiences, gotten better at like empathizing with people, but in the process, we've given up the idea that there's anything challengeable or critical about the conversation. So like you can, so it's almost like it's a good change. Like we're listening to people more. We're willing to hear people's stories and willing to give them a lot of airtime. But in the process, we're somehow not allowed to participate in analyzing it.
Well, and I think, it, you know, a lot of times what it is that when somebody says that's my truth, and I think this flows a lot out of politics of identity, where yes. somebody says, like, they preface a statement by saying, like, as a gay man, or, you know, as a Black American, or as a post-Christian, or, you know, and they're sort of like, you know, as a sexual abuse survivor, whatever mm-hmm. it is that I preface it with. And so what I'm saying is like, look, the reason I think this way, or the reason I see things this way or understand them this way is like, I'm uniquely positioned. I have a moral high ground here. And therefore
I'm uniquely positioned. And so if you aren't me, you have nothing to say about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly shouldn't, you can agree with me, but you can't challenge me. Because you don't have a standing to challenge it.
Yes. You're right.
And this is one of the things where, like, you know, as a white man, like, as soon as the word my truth comes out, you're like, it's like code for, like, be quiet. You can say nothing. As a straight white man, you
should have nothing to say, yeah.
Your truth is that you should be quiet.
Well, and the truth is white men probably should have been much more quiet, right? But in the process, it's kind of like there's an uninterrogable quality to yeah. what's being said.
The problem is that white men were always speaking their truth and calling it the truth.
Yeah.
And so now everybody else wants to speak their truth. But like there is this other thing called the truth. And white men may have appropriated the for their truth, but like white men need to say, like, look, many of the things we've told you are our truth. Like women exist to serve our needs. Like that's our truth. That's my truth. You know? It's not the truth. And of course, you know, Christianity and all the world's religions are also kind of guilty of saying this thing that is our story. It's the story. It's the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, but I think that, you know, it's funny because the person that sent that article also sent, or that sent the question, also sent an article that was an interview with Dan Dennett.
Yes, yes, yes. In the New York Times.
Yes. So you focused, it's funny, like, I actually didn't take the question very seriously. I thought, like, you know, what do I have to say about that? But I read the article. Mm-hmm. I'm taking the question seriously.
What do you think of the article?
Oh, I really liked it.
He talks about my truth in it, doesn't he?
Yes. I don't know if he does, but what I do know is that what he said was he really makes a case for there really is a thing called the truth, and it's not an opinion. Yeah, your truth isn't what we're talking about here. Well, it wasn't what we're after. In the search for truth, we're not looking for yours, mine, or anyone else's. We're looking for the thing. Mm-hmm. And he makes a fairly simple case. You know. And so the person asking the question, it's funny because they sent the article, and I think the answer is sort of, the simple answer is in the article, where Dan Dennett says, look, you know, they just, you know, a few years ago, some mathematician proved Fermat's last theorem. You know, it was just this big moment in mathematics where this math problem that people had been trying to solve for like more than a couple hundred years, and some mathematician finally figured it out. And Dan Dennett says, "I couldn't tell you. I don't know a thing about advanced mathematics. So like, how do I know that this guy really proved it?" He said, "I'll tell you how I know, because there's a whole community of mathematicians." And they all tried to prove the guy wrong, and they all tested it out. Not because they don't like him, but because they're like, there's a competition to be the rightest about things, to figure things out first, and also because there's like a concern. And so they all sort of looked at his thing and like, oh, you know what? He's right. You know what? That's it. And Dan Dennett said, when the whole community test a person's truth and they can't prove it wrong, then it moves from being that person's theory or you know, to being the truth, or the truth as far as we know. And what he was basically doing is just like, this is the scientific method.
Yes.
Somebody puts a hypothesis out there, they test it, they say, this is why I think it's true. And a bunch of other people check their data who know. And if they can't prove them wrong, they go like, yeah, you know what? I think he's got something there. I think she's got something there. And Dennett says, like, I think that's how you do it. And he's, you know, he's kind of like making a little bit of a case for, we probably need to school our young people more in the scientific method and in the idea of like that truth is something that is maybe postulated or put forth by an individual, but ultimately can only be verified by a community.
Right, right.
You know, which is interesting, especially for those of us who came out of, you know, I guess religions based on divine revelation.
Yeah.
Because divine revelation works very differently in a religion. You know, what makes the Bible true to Christians is not that it can be empirically verified by, you know, testing it out. It's like, it's because of the source. Like God says it, that's what makes it true. It was revealed by God. God knows the truth. Not even God knows the truth. God defines the truth. If God says, you know, up is down, then guess what? That's how it is.
Right.
I mean, when I was a kid, I remember going to Bible school, and one of the little phrases they taught us was, you know, somebody would get up and said, God said it, I believe it, that settles it.
Yeah, right. It's that simple.
And that's how we, you know, and that's, and I think that one of the really important things, and it's funny, like there is a problem. I think the scientific method is probably our best human device. And as humanists, like it sounds funny that we would, in a sense, be advocates for the scientific method. And I think that's different from being advocates for science. Because I think a lot of times people are like, you know, I believe in science. And science is a bunch of human beings doing stuff, and they make mistakes, and they're motivated by politics and money, and like, you know, I don't trust science, you know, in that narrow way of like, if the scientists all agree on it, that makes it true.
Well, you believe in the process. Like
I believe in the process.
Yeah, like over time, that works. It may not work in every single instance, you can't, but you trust the overall process.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think it was it George W. Bush who or Stephen Colbert, when he was criticizing George W. Bush, said something about like truthiness.
Right, right.
He invented a word.
Yeah.
And I think that, I trust the process, even though it gets it wrong. And, you know, because I mean, you think about like what they've told us about eating or cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And at one minute, like, you should eat more of this. No, you should eat less of this. No, you shouldn't eat any of this. Oh, you should, you know, and you know, this is bad cholesterol. This is good cholesterol. Oh, it turns out the bad is good. And you know, some people go like, that's why you can't trust science, because they make mistakes. And I go like, what I trust about science is that they have a method for changing their mind.
Yes, that's kind of what I was getting at. When I said you trust the process, I think that's more what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so, like, my trust in science is not absolute. It is relational. Mm-hmm. I do not trust science willy-nilly is always right. But what I do trust is that science is the best way to get the most truth. You know, so you end up sort of like, this is the best account we have of why things are the way they are. It there's probably a lot wrong with it, but it just keeps, you know, we're still working on it. It just keeps getting a little bit better every year.
Yeah.
So I think like that, you know, in answer to the question, like, what can we humanists do in this thing? It's like, even in our politics, even in our news stories, even in stuff, is we sort of we've got to kind of try to bring that method into forms of discourse that we didn't used to. You know, a news story has to be treated like a hypothesis. This might be the truth. Let's test it out.
So what you were saying about science is the same way that a news organization that I trust. I don't think every word is going to be true. But I think the process, I trust the process of bringing that to where a good example was when there was a hospital destroyed in Gaza, and the news organizations of the world, most of them reported that Israel had done it, and that's what they reported. And most of them then issued a retraction when it turned out not to be true. So I don't believe that that they get everything right. I just believe that overall, you're going to find it's the best process we have for finding the truth in the news. Of course, in the news, it gets a bit more, it's a bit, I think, more messy maybe than science. Yeah.
It's super messy.
Yeah.
So here's the thing though. And I think that for, especially, you know, when we sort of touch on like the difference between divine revelation and the scientific method, I think there's the reality is that for many of us who left Christianity, the difficulty is that what we really liked about divine revelation wasn't so much the truth of it. Like, we trusted it. It was true. But we wanted the Bible to be true for a very specific reason. Because the Bible didn't just promise to tell us what was true. It simultaneously promised that because this is true, we will also tell you what is right, what you must do. And that's the kind of truth that good people want most of all, is tell me what's the right thing to do, what's right and what's wrong.
Moral truth.
Yeah. And the,
well, that's
weird
even
thing
hard. That's even harder, isn't it? It's even harder than the news.
Yeah, because I think what Dan Dennett ends up saying is like, look, I can tell you how to advocate for objective truth. And you go like, oh, can you also try to advocate for objective morality? And then they go like, hey, Dan, step back. There's no such thing.
Do you really think there's no such thing as objective morality?
No, there's no such thing. Morality is all about doing what is right. And the question is, right for who? Or right for what? Right for everybody? Right for you? Right for you and your tribe? Like, what's right? I mean, right now you have political situations all over the world where, like, what is right for one group of people is not right, is not good for the other group of people. And you go like, well, so.
And they both think they're doing right.
They want to appeal to like the universal right.
Yeah.
But like, tell me anything that is right for everybody.
I'm being careful. I mean, there are things, of course, occurring to my mind, like, you know, do not kill. Seems to be a fairly universal, but then it's not, right?
No, it's not at all.
It's not at all. I'm trying to think of this. I was thinking about stealing. I was thinking about like stealing what someone else has, but that relies on some concepts like private property. In certain tribes, there was no such thing as having your own stuff, right?
Sure. And what about if your kid is starving and there's a rich guy who's got like who's got food galore,
right?
And he drops a cupcake. Can I steal it? Do I have to return it to him, or can I take it and give it to my starving child? It's right to steal. And so, sometimes it's immoral not to steal.
So morally, the concept "my truth" might make some sense.
Maybe instead of, but you see, morally, what we don't say is what we probably ought to say is not "my truth," but we ought to say what I think is right, or what's right for me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in Christianity, one of the things I loved was, you know, the idea that like, if God said it is wrong to commit adultery, that was it. You didn't have to think about why it was wrong to commit adultery. You didn't have to think about circumstances under which adultery might be appropriate or even necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, like it was objective. Like it was just there. You didn't question it. And I think that for a lot of people, when they leave the faith, I talk to a lot of people, you know, when I coach people or counsel people that have left the faith, one of the things that they struggle with is, you know, like someone like I might know somebody who's in a very difficult marriage, very painful marriage. And when they were a Christian, they were like, I know I have to stay. You know, that's what my faith tells me, is that like, this is a promise I made and I have to keep it and it's before God, and they would stay. And then they if they lose their faith in God, a lot of times you're like, well, then they leave, right? And they're like, no, they're still like in their core of their being, they still have the sense of like, it's not right to leave a marriage.
Yeah.
And you say, but why? And they go like, I don't know. Or like, I want to leave. And somebody might say, well, you know, it seems like that would be the right thing for you to do. And they go like, but how do I know if it's right? Like, it's going to hurt my wife. Like, she doesn't want to break up the marriage, or it, she won't, you know, she'll struggle to find a new relationship because of something, and I won't. Like, it'll be easier for me. And so a person goes like, how do I make a complicated moral decision in the absence of moral absolutes?
Right.
And you know, like I have friends who are in that exact situation where they're like, I don't know what the right thing to do is. What they're sort of lacking is a religious framework. You know, because when I was a Christian, you know, if I was on a used car lot trying to figure out whether to buy the $6,000 Honda or the $12,000 Chrysler, you know, you say, well, that had nothing to do with the Bible. And oh yeah, it was all about stewardship and marshaling my money for the poor and you know, and safety for my children. And like, but like, I would actually try to use biblical principles to help me figure out what was the best decision to make in light of the kingdom of God. And so when I'm buying a used car now, how do I determine not what I want? I know what I want. But is it okay for me to spend that much money on the car? Or is that the, you know, is that the right choice for my family? Is that the right choice for the world?
Well, you know, on a practical level, I think you would probably be either consciously or not shaped by your earlier programming there.
Yeah.
That's
what I'm saying.
Yeah, you'd be walking to the car lot and you'd think you're making it for one reason. This is the other thing about moral truth. It's very, it's sometimes unconscious. Like, you don't exactly know why you feel certain ways about it. It's a very emotional thing.
Yeah, and it's very enculturated. And that means, like, if you grow up with a religious background that teaches you that your morality is based on objective truth, that really grooves it in there. Like, this is just the right thing to do. Like, it's the right thing to do, and that's the truth. That's
well,
not.
And I think morally, people are very. It's a felt rather than thought.
It's in our guts. I mean, Jonathan Haidt and the righteous mind, and you know, like kind of these core gut level, values that we have.
Yes, yes.
And so, what happens when somebody's the basis of their morality changes? They're still prone to like live a simple lifestyle. They're still prone to help the poor. They're still prone to like they want to be kind and all these things. But then they say like, why? Because you know, morality is easy when like what you want to do is the thing you think you ought to do. Mm-hmm. It becomes hard when you're like, I don't want to do this thing, but I have this kind of gut level sense that I'm supposed to, or other people are saying I'm supposed to, or somebody's challenging me and I have to explain to them why I'm doing this thing. And then you have to appeal to something. Like, why are you, you know, and when you're in a religion, it gives you a clear sort of like down to the bones foundational Like, my decision is based on the truth. And when you lose that, it becomes difficult. Now, I think it was you I was having this conversation with, you know, a while back, and you kept going to this, what was it? There was some principle of anonymity where you were like, the way to make a decision is to, do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I remember exactly what we were talking about. So I think it comes from John Rawls, The Veil of Ignorance, where behind the veil, you have to make a decision, a moral decision, but you don't know. It's basically a thought experiment. You don't know who you're going to be on the other side of the veil. So
if you're a millionaire trying to decide how much money to donate to malaria research.
Yeah. So you don't know whether you're going to be the millionaire in the situation on the other end of the decision, or whether you're going to be the person with malaria, or, you know, the community, the disadvantaged community that it affects. So the idea of the veil of ignorance is just, it puts you outside of your own.
How would you organize society if you didn't know where you would land in the thing? And you go like, well, I guess I would want to make it work for everybody because I could end up being anybody.
Yes. And it takes your own self-interest out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Which is so funny because, you know, I remember the first times you mentioned that to me, and I think I just laughed. I was like, that's not how...
It was a very encouraging response.
That's not how anybody actually makes a moral decision.
No, it's not. It's not. I think it's encouraging people to make them more in that way, but yes, you're right. No one actually does.
I mean, and that's why I remember when we had... Todd May, the philosopher guy, on to talk about.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, talk about decency. And what he said is, he said, all those kind of thought experiments and all those kind of like, what would be best, do the thing that would be best for everybody, take yourself out of the equation, just do what's best for the world. Mm-hmm. And he said, like, that's philosophy for moral paragons, for people that want to be moral heroes. And he said, most of us, we want to be decent people. We want to be good to our families. We want to be nice neighbors. We don't want to be villains in the larger scheme of things. But really, our primary interests are for the people closest to us. And so we are, in a sense, not morally neutral. We're like, I want to do the right thing to a point.
I want to do the right thing, but I also want to go see movies sometimes, and I want to go to dinner,
And honestly, I want to do the right thing for everybody, unless it's gonna really cause a difficulty for my family and me, in which case I'm gonna do what's best for my family and me. You know, that's where I was so used to operating in a religious framework where I had a big narrative that said, like, because God is God and Jesus is the Savior, and we're all gonna live in heaven unless we do the wrong things, in which we go to hell. Like, because the world operates this way, I should buy this used car. I should not sleep with this woman, at least until we're married. There were all these things that I did because Jesus is Lord, mm-hmm. because that is the truth of the universe. Because the universe works this way, I should live this way. And when I left the faith, you know, the first thing I realized was, I got to come up with a new reason to do the right thing. And that was the biggest challenge for me. It's like, I wanted to do the right thing, but I also needed a framework to help me decide what the right thing was.
Yes.
That wasn't just obeying the Bible. You know, I think that that's the moral truth is the thing that is the bigger crisis. There is a crisis of trust. And Dan Dennett gives a great answer to that. Which in the scientific method, but I think there's this other problem, and that is there is this other kind of truth that's really important, moral truth, and that's essentially subjective. And so what I would say, the answer to the question to that is, what can we humanists do? And I go, like, you probably need to come up with a pretty clear framework of why you think something is right Like, on what basis do you claim that something is right? You know, to say it's self-evident isn't good enough, because it clearly isn't self-evident to everybody. Whatever you think, there's somebody who thinks differently. So, like, tell me why you think that's the right thing to do. And I think we have to become much more clear for our own sakes. Like my friend who's stuck in the marriage that there's no kids, there's nobody. It's just him and this woman. And he's like, it's going to hurt her if I leave. It's going to hurt me if I stay. What should I do? What's right? And I'm sort of like, well, you're going to need a basis to make that. Like, and it's got to be grounded somewhere. And so he says to me, like, where's yours grounded? And I really thought about it. And I realized that, like, there is this one basic, like, first article of faith that, like, I take for granted. Life is the most important thing. Life is good. That's one place where I really love the Dennett article, because when he was talking about, you know, the guy who was interviewing him said, like, hey, but, like, what do you do with religious people? And he's like, you know, I get religious people, you know, they're looking for answers. And that, he said, the thing that I have found is that, you know, the actual story of how we came here is better. Like, it's more exciting. It's more thrilling. Like, what's happened, you know, the evolution, like, the real story of how life came to be is amazing. And he's sort of like, you know, he said, they want, you know, there to be real magic. And he said, I want to turn them on to, like, I want to turn them on to the magical qualities of reality. You know, the magic of brains evolving between our own ears, the wonder of how the planet came to be, the wonder of how our eyes and our ears came to be, the wonder of how our social connections developed, you know, language, like, all of this stuff that has sort of sprung up out of just pure matter and energy. He's like, that's the amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And he says, like, that's the thing, in a sense, that is my God. You know, that's the thing I worship. That's the thing I revere. That's the thing that I, you know, it's Ursula Goodenough again, like, you know, sort of, you know, religious naturalism, like, life is the thing. And I don't have a hard time with that.
Right.
And that's, I feel like I have that in common, not only with other people, but with mosquitoes, with bears, with, mm-hmm. with birds, like, everything wants to keep pushing forward. And everything wants life wants to live, and life values life, and living things value life. And so I'm like, okay, I'll start there. And I go, like, you know, honestly, I not only think it's amazing, but I'm also a little bit prejudiced, because, again, my truth, my experience means that, like, yeah, I value human life more than I value the other kinds.
Yeah.
I think the cockroaches center themselves in the narrative, the mice center themselves in the narrative. Yes. And I see the world from the perspective of human, and I am most committed to human life and human flourishing. If I'm really honest, that's why I call myself a humanist.
Right.
And so you go, like, okay, I value life, particularly human life and human flourishing. That is my ultimate, my original value, the thing I value above all else, upon which everything else rests. And then you go, like, so what's good? And I go, oh, what's good is that which contributes to human flourishing. And what's bad is that which diminishes human flourishing. Like, that's, you know, that becomes my standard. And then, then it gets a little tricky, because different people define human flourishing differently. Mm-hmm. But at least I've got something I'm looking for. I'm like, okay, what's my definition of human flourishing? And, you know, if you want to get really technical about it, I'm sort of like, you know, I think human flourishing is not only when life keeps going forward, but when people live longer, when they live better, when they live happier, when they thrive. And so, like, that's, you know, that's literally how I'm trying to make my moral decisions, based on, like, you know, how does this contribute not only to my flourishing, but to the flourishing of my tribe?
That makes sense to me. Do you think that most people, because we were talking about this as a function of like, this is most people could do this. Do you think most people could do this?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really do. I mean, and don't get me wrong.
Of course, you have to trust their intentions too. Like, they can't be trying to get away with, what you might say like is an immoral act, dressed up as a moral act. Do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it only works internally. Like, because I mean, I can, you know, I'm sure a good Nazi. I should never quote Nazis, but like, you know, somebody
or use the phrase a good Nazi.
Right. But somebody like somebody could do something that was on the face of it, a horrible act, torture a child. And they could take the perma thing and they could go, let me explain to you how this creates positive emotions and engagement. I was fully focused and, you know, relationships. Cause it's something I can share with other child torturers and, you know, and they could make an argument where they go like, I actually think this was the best thing to do. And you go like, come on, this is bullshit. Right. But like the question is not whether you can make that argument to the external world. The question is, can you make it to yourself?
Right.
Do you really think that this is in the best interests of life? Like, not just your life. Your life matters, yes, but not just your life. Like, in terms of like the amount of pleasure that you'll get and the amount of suffering the other person will get, the amount of relationship that will be enabled for you, the amount of relationship that will be lost, the relational potential that will be lost by this other person. And I don't think you can make that. I don't think you could, in good faith or in good conscience, make the calculation that way. The question I'm not asking is like, how does a bad person get away with shit? The thing I'm asking is, how does a good guy, like my friend, how does he have a framework that enables him to make a decision and say in his heart, I know there's going to be some suffering here, but I genuinely believe this is not just what I want to do. Because that's not going to be enough to motivate him. I genuinely believe this is the right thing to do based on my values. I value life. I value human flourishing. And I define human flourishing this way. And by that definition, and with that value in mind, I think this is the right thing to do. Because that's what he's going to need to make a move.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do think he, you know, this guy I have in mind, but I also think just like in general, I think people can make decisions that way internally and in intimate relationships. I think a couple that share that value can have a conversation about it and go like, what do you think we should do here? And let's really think about like, how's this going to affect her ability to form meaningful relationships? You know, like we'll make more money doing this. And you go like, yeah. But like, we're going to move across the country away from all of our friends. Like, is it like... We really believe that our belief is that flourishing depends more on relationships than it does on material wealth to a point. You're like, well, but what if that puts us in utter poverty? Like, yeah, you know, if we're in utter poverty, we're not going to have many positive emotions. And we're going to have a very difficult time if we're in survival mode in making things better for other people. And it may really harm our relationship with our kids. Because they may be really resentful of the suffering that they're going through. Hey, maybe we should go this other way. Maybe we need to secure our finances before we go and volunteer give all of our money to UNICEF to help refugee children. You're like, oh, like it's, but you're still, at least you have a framework in which you're comparing, I don't want to say apples to apples, but at least you have a framework in which you're sort of going like, this is our checklist of things that we think through before we figure out what will lead to human flourishing.
Well, I think it's interesting how like we started off with this idea of truth in general.
Truth.
And people think about facts, and moral truth is a completely, you know, it's a very, very interesting subset of it, because it is true. It's one of those things where it's like there are things to figure out that don't have obvious answers in day-to-day life. Yeah. And at least if you have sort of a rough compass, you know, and some people that can be with you in the in the thought of it, at least you're trying your best to live a true life.
Yeah. Yeah. But the big leap here is Dennett says, listen, there is a way. We've come up with a way to come up with a more or less objective truth. Like, there are ways to figure out what is true. And there's this way we figured out that's probably our best bet. Mm-hmm. And you go like, yep, that's good for objective truth. But the big leap is that for most of us, we have been taught that right and wrong is as objective as true and untrue. And the fact of the matter is that right and wrong are essentially subjective decisions. And the stuff we've just talked about is what you do once you accept that it's a subjective decision. And then you have to figure out, like, okay, subjectively, from where I stand, what do I value? Right and wrong are value decisions. They are not objective fact decisions.
Right, right. They spring from those underlying
They spring from values. And yeah. So if on the other side of religion, in religion, you could reach for your morality in the same place that you reach for your factual truth. You know, 7-day creation, it's a fact. Bible says it. Don't commit adultery. It's a fact. Bible says it. And in the post supernatural world, you reach one place for your facts, and you reach for another place for your morality, and you reach for your facts in the scientific method, and you reach for your morality in your values. And you have to admit, like, my values are in many ways subjective and culturally defined and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, yeah, I got that. But you're like, is there any value that you can go as universal? And I'm like, yeah, I got this one value that's universal. So that's the one I'm recommending. Life. Mm-hmm.
That's good. All right. Thank you, Bart.
Once again, claiming to give a response. I have acted like I am the arbiter of moral truth.
I think you were fairly clear that you were not. Hey, I wanna have you thank a few patrons before we go.
That's the right thing to do.
Subjectively or objectively?
You know, if you like this podcast, like, very subjectively, like, I shouldn't.
But it's based on the value of liking the podcast.
Yeah, if you think we just put out a bunch of terrible stuff that's going to derail people from the truth and send them to hell, then it's the wrong thing to do to support it. But if you think we're doing something good here, then it's the right thing to do to thank these people. And so I'm going to do it. And this is one of my favorites is the first name that came up on the list for this week is Dunk Tank. D-U-N-C, like Duncan Tank. And I don't think this is actually a guy named Duncan Tank, but it might be. Whoever you are, Dunk Tank, we like you.
I love nicknames.
Alvin Poblacion. And that is a completely new name to me. And that means that's a new person that's joined our team. Beautiful. Jesse Voigt. Rebecca Reed, Happy Hubby. Okay, now, like, again, Happy Hubby, if you're listening to this, please write in. I am going to guess almost with 100% certainty that at some point you were an evangelical Christian. Thomas Stone, Joel Miller. I know who, if that's the Joel Miller, I think it is. I know who that is. And what's more is I have an email that Joel Miller sent me 4 years ago that I am still trying to figure out how to answer. So bless his heart for still sticking with me. Ruby Newman. John, has any listener to the show sent more emails than Ruby Newman?
And uplifting and encouraging emails, yeah.
And emails in which she's wrestling with ideas that one of our guests said or something we said. Like, Ruby Newman is a kind of a hero of the process of trying to become more human. And Brian Olson. Yeah. thank you all. And most of all, thank you all for listening. But also thank you for making it possible for other people to listen. And hopefully you can justify that as a contribution to human flourishing.
All right.
All right. We'll catch you next time on Humanize Me.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. Hey, you could be larger than life, bigger than the world, living out the hopes and dreams of every boy and every girl. Hey, you could fly higher than the sky, shine brighter than the stars. You can have all you ever wanted. Yeah. Thank you.